Hey everybody, welcome to another episode of the podcast. I'm your host, Brian Keane, online fitness coach, nutritionist, and 3 times best-selling author, here to help you by deconstructing expert guests on all things health, fitness, and mindset. Today's guest is a round 2 appearance with Dr. Stacey Sims. In our first episode, back in July 2021, episode 338, we talked about nutrition and training sex differences and why women are not small men. In today's podcast, we do a deep dive into her new book, Next Level, which goes through your guide to kicking ass, feeling great, and crushing goals through menopause and beyond. So this episode is very specific, very niche for anyone that is in the perimenopausal age bracket, in your early to mid 40s or postmenopause. So after that, and the transition and what you need to do with your training, your nutrition, your sleep, your supplementation to reduce your symptoms, to feel your absolute best, to keep your body fat and keep your body composition where you want it to be, and everything in between. Also, if you are working in the fitness industry, similar to me as a fitness coach, personal trainer, you will get loads of value from today's episode. Outside of that, it's one that I'd probably skip over. I think it's, you have a friend and you have a family member who is in perimenopause or postmenopause, please recommend this podcast to them. Or if you're a fitness professional who wants to educate yourself, then this episode is for you. If you fall outside of that, today's episode goes very deep within that particular topic. So if it's not an area of interest for you, then I would skip over this one, but definitely share it with your family members and friends, because there's so much value in here, very similar to the first episode I did with Dr. Stacey back in July 2021. So without further ado, here is today's podcast with Dr. Stacey Sims on Next Level, your guide to kicking ass, feeling great, and crushing goals through menopause and beyond. Enjoy. Hey everybody, welcome to another episode of the podcast. I am delighted to be joined today with my guest, Dr. Stacey Sims. Stacey was on the podcast in July 2021 in episode 338, talking about nutrition and training, sex differences, and why women are not small men. In today's podcast, we are going to take a look at her new best-selling book, Next Level. For active women, menopause can hit hard, but it doesn't have to be the end of you kicking ass at the gym, on the trail, in the saddle, or wherever you work out. Once you understand your physiology, you can teach and you can work with it to optimize your performance. In Next Level, Stacey teaches the underlying cause of menopause, the hormonal change that are causing all the symptoms you're feeling and their impact on your wellness and performance, and what to do about it. I'm looking forward to catching up on all things menopause and fitness in today's episode. Stacey, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me. I'm excited to chat.
I want to jump straight in, because obviously your first book, Roar, was a tremendous success and helped so many people, but you went in a slightly different direction with Next Level. Talk to us about the origins of the book and why you focused your attention on menopause.
When Roar came out, I ended up with a plethora of questions from women who are in that 40 plus age group going, well, none of this really works for me. You had that one chapter on menopause, but I want more. I want more. And then also from my background working in the Women's Health Initiative and kind of that space, realizing that there really wasn't any explanation or any go-to for women who were active, because almost all the research and all the recommendations are done on women who are not active, hit menopause, now have all these cardiometabolic issues. So when women are already fit and they're racing or training hard, there was nothing out there. So getting just inundated with questions of, what do I do? How do I train? How do I work with what's going on? I'm going crazy. And my co-author was starting to go through some of that as well. And so when I told her just some simple things to do, and she's like, oh my gosh, this works so well. Now we have all the stuff that we need to do to write this book.
And what I said to you right before we went on air, I, like, selfishly as a coach and a trainer, I'm so happy that you wrote it, because I don't serve this space. I don't work with women in this area for the most part. And you're putting out fantastic content on Instagram and online. And now the book is going to be a tremendous resource for people. So I want to unpack that a little bit. You start with part one, explained, and just because there's a lot of people who are listening to this podcast who are either entering menopause or in it at the minute, or are similar to me, where you're fitness coaches, personal trainers, people who are trying to advance their own skill set and knowledge. So talk to us about the first part, you know, menopause explained, the stats, the stigma, the science, and we'll jump off from there.
Yeah, so I think a lot of it has to do with the historical perspective of, you know, first we have all the taboo-ness about the menstrual cycle, but then it gets even worse with menopause because it's a definitive point where women age, where men age linearly, and you'll see it in popular media, you'll see it across the board where there's this distinguished male gentleman, but for women, it's not portrayed that way at all. And there's this push for women to stay young. So the word menopause is like golden girls from back in the 80s, right? And so that was the image that ever, and probably still is, the image that so many people have. And there's a westernized idea that you need to stop it. Like you need to take hormones or you need to do everything you can to stop it when it's actually a natural part of aging. And we see in other cultures, it's embraced. So we see that, oh, I've got to this point, I'm not responsible for reproducing, but I have all of this experience and I have the rest of my life to do the things that I want to do and I can do them. So it's this mind shift. So when we're talking about it in the book, I'm trying to explain, look, you can have a positive spin on it. And we know that women who have a more positive outlook on it have less severe symptoms because the psychological and physiological are so intertwined. And when we really start talking about it and we have these images of what menopause is, everyone thinks that menopause is like that post-menopause time point, and that's where all these body composition changes happen. But in actual fact, it's that time period before menopause. It's called perimenopause, and this can start in your early to mid-40s when the hormones start changing, and this is where we start seeing all of the symptomology, the body composition changes, some increased risk in blood glucose and intolerance to insulin. So all of these things that are supposedly for the older woman who is in, quote, menopause. But menopause is just one point on the calendar that is marking 12 months after all your periods have stopped. And the 5 to 6 years before that is perimenopause, where we can really do some significant interventions to prevent all the really negative aspects that are associated with menopause. And then, of course, that one point of time, menopause, after that is postmenopause. And that's the point where everyone associates being old and frail. And it doesn't have to be that way.
What are some of the hormones and symptoms then that, we'll start with perimenopause, because there's a huge chunk of this podcast who fall into that bracket, an age bracket, and it's educating themselves and arming them with the tools to, well, how do I approach my nutrition, my training, my recovery, etc. Talk to us about some of the symptoms, hormones, and we can talk about the kind of the science of the menopause transition as well. But I want to kind of, just for people who are unfamiliar or who aren't sure of all the symptoms to be watching out for, just to unpack that a little bit first.
Yeah, so it's really because estrogen progesterone ratios are changing. So you might still have regular menstrual cycles, especially early stages, but you'll notice a difference in the bleed pattern. So you might go from really steady 7-day bleeding to 2 really, really heavy days of bleeding, or you might have some spotting and then really light bleeding. So it's paying attention to the bleed pattern, because once the bleed pattern starts changing, then you know that everything that you're doing, like what's in your head, so many women are like, why am I so tired? Why am I so anxious? Why is my training not working for me? Is it because I'm stressed? Am I not eating well? So all of these things that we associate with not having really good fitness outcomes really can be tied to this changeover in these ratios of hormones. So I see it a lot when women are in their early 40s and they're smashing it in the gym or they're smashing it in their races, and then they hit about 44, 45 and they're like, wait a second, what's going on? Now I'm putting on belly fat. I'm really tired, not recovering well. And if I go to my GP, they're just like, oh, you're highly stressed and you need to look at how you're going to mitigate stress. But the stress and that sympathetic drive comes from this change of hormones. So women are tired but wired, and they just can't hit the intensities they want to, or they feel like they're always like fighting to get somewhere in the gym, and their sleep patterns are disrupted. And again, you know, their mood is changing all over the place. They might be depressed or anxious, or they might be irrationally angry. And a lot of people attribute it to lifestyle stress, like work stress, kid stress, all that kind of stuff. But in fact, it's this changeover of the ratios of these hormones.
What are some of the things people can do then to minimize some of the negative effects in perimenopause in particular?
So this is where we look at what these hormones do to the body to support it. And then we find an external stress that will stimulate the body the way these hormones used to and allow you to recover. So when we look at things like estrogen, so estrogen is tightly tied to the myosin filament of muscle contraction, of actin myosin. And when estrogen starts to go down, you start to lose the integrity of the myosin. And estrogen is women's testosterone. So when estrogen goes down, you also start losing the impetus for lean mass and protein synthesis. So this is where we look, okay, from a neuromuscular standpoint, we need to find a way to stimulate the muscle to keep that myosin integrity and to enhance the muscle contraction. So this is where we look at lifting heavy. So we're not doing body weight stuff. We're not doing, 8 to 15 reps. We're actually talking about power training. We look at women's physiology prior to, and we know that women do better with power training anyway, with regards to leaning up and getting strong without bulking. Mm-hmm. So when we get into this point, we want that power training, that 0 to 6 reps. Sometimes it's easier to say to 3 to 5 mechanism, 3 to 5 exercises, 3 to 5 reps, 3 to 5 minutes recovery. And really emphasizing that it's neuromuscular, it's not cardiovascular. So as you go in to lift something heavy, you are recruiting more fibers from a nerve standpoint to actually lift that load. So then your body's like, hey, wait a second, I need to be able to do this. You have a better neuromuscular connection as well as the impetus to build more fibers and stronger fibers in that whole connection. When we look at what's happening from a metabolic standpoint, estrogen is tightly tied to IGF-1 as well. So when we're looking at post-exercise or muscle protein synthesis, there's usually 3 pathways for muscle protein synthesis in women. But when we hit perimenopause and postmenopause and we lose the estrogen drive of IGF-1, we only have 2. So that is the mechanical load and amino acids. So after lifting, you have to dose with protein. And because women are more anabolically resistant for muscle protein synthesis, we have to look at minimum a 35 gram dose of high quality protein. So you're looking around that 3.5 to 4 gram leucine dose with your other essential amino acids. Because those two things of lifting heavy and then supplying the amino acids support the body in a stress and recovery mechanism the way estrogen used to. So then your body is getting the stimulus of the stress to keep and build lean mass so you don't lose it. And you're also getting that idea behind what estrogen used to do. And so the body's learning. So you keep the stress going and you can build that tissue, keep lean mass, reduce body fat. When we look at some of the things that progesterone does. So progesterone is also responsible for things like bone growth. It's also responsible for glucose control, as is estrogen. So when we're looking at bone mineral density going down and putting on visceral body fat, we have to look at what kind of cardiovascular stuff we're doing to support the body when progesterone's bottoming out. So this is that high intensity, so the sprint interval training, not your 45-minute F45 type moderate intensity stuff. We're talking full gas for 20, 30 seconds, and then you really want that 1 to 2 minutes recovery. Because when you have such a high stress, it causes some epigenetic changes within the muscle to open up more GLUT4 proteins. So when you have more GLUT4 proteins active, glucose comes in without insulin. So then progesterone's job, as well as to put that glucose in, it's not as dire to have progesterone. We can also do this with plyometrics, because when you're doing plyometric work, which can also fit in that super high intensity work, you're getting multidirectional stress that stimulates the bone without progesterone and estrogen trying to help. So this is what I mean. We're looking at those external stressors that will stimulate the body the way these hormones used to support the body.
Would that be the same advice then for postmenopause as perimenopause, or does it vary or slightly go in a different direction then?
We try to get the patterning going before we hit menopause and postmenopause. And then we also look at the periodization, because women are more endurant from recovery standpoint of intervals. They don't need as much time, but they do need more recovery between hard sessions. So we look at like a 2-week on, so to speak, where you're doing lots of high quality work for over the course of 2 weeks. And then you have 1 week of deload. So it's not off, but you're reducing the intensity. You're working more on mobilization. You're working on technique under the bar. You're doing more recovery type mechanisms to really kind of hold on to that mobility and that movement, increasing range of motion, and then absorbing all the hard training from the previous 2 weeks.
Amazing. And something I want to unpack is the nutrition, because I've actually worked with quite a lot of females for perimenopause, just because of that age bracket, that with people who are struggling. And something that they've came in with, that through your research and through stuff you've posted on Instagram and following down in that rabbit hole, a lot of the girls or females and women that come to me with perimenopause in that state will be massively under eating and massively reducing calories, because they're like, well, I need to get my body fat down, I need to get my belly fat down. Talk to us about eating enough.
Yeah, so one of the first things that happens when you start hitting this period in your life is women will say, I turn squishy overnight and I put on all these kilos of belly fat. And this is perpetuated a lot by that moderate intensity work, where we stay in that zone that's too hard to be easy to optimize recovery and aerobic work. And it's too easy to be hard to get the stimulus that we want to stop that visceral fat gain. Because when we stay in that moderate intensity zone, we also increase cortisol. And we know there's already an increase in the baseline cortisol anyway, because women are in a greater sympathetic drive at this point, because there's so many metabolic and hormonal changes. So it's really important to stay out of that zone. Otherwise, you just keep increasing cortisol and keeping the stimulus to put on that belly fat. And it is hard because of the mentality that a lot of us grew up with of calories in, calories out. If you're starting to put on weight, then you need to cut calories and train more. But in actuality, you need to eat more and train less. And the training needs to be high quality. And I work with a lot of endurance athletes as well. And they're like, well, what do you mean I can't train volume? It's like, no, we look at the quality. And there is a time and a place, but we really have to rein in that volume. The woman's body is already really well attuned from sex differences at birth to go long and slow. So we don't want to train that. We want to get the other stimulus. So when it comes to nutrition, it's really important to understand that you need more protein, because we become more anabolically resistant. So this is where the upper echelons of that 2 to 2.3 grams of protein per kilogram per day, having regular doses at every meal. But most importantly, you need to fuel for what you are doing. And, you know, you have all these pushes of, oh, fasted training, and you hear it from GPs who are encountering peri and postmenopausal women. You should try the ketogenic diet. You should try fasted. All of this increases that sympathetic drive, mm-hmm. which then increases cortisol, which reduces your body's ability to shift that visceral fat. And a lot of the recommendations, again, come from 2 studies done on sedentary, overweight women. So, of course, they did better when they had some modification of their diet through time-restricted eating and keto. But for active women, it does not work. It perpetuates that sympathetic drive. It perpetuates that increase in cortisol. That moderate intensity stuff increases cortisol. So you need to fuel for what you are doing and recover with protein. And this is where people are like, oh, but I'm not hungry. You have to have something. It could be half a banana. It could be, like I've said before, a protein fortified coffee. Just something to bring that blood sugar up to stimulate the body saying, hey, yeah, I've got some nutrition coming in. And a lot of people will also go, well, is it low energy availability or is it perimenopause? And when we look at perimenopause, it's better to err on the side that it's both. So really, really making sure you are eating enough and really, really honing in on that resistance training and that protein intake to get those body composition changes that people want.
Yeah, from my experience, perimenopausal women, particularly the ones that listen to this podcast, who follow me, who follow you online, they're active. So training is normally a part of their life, but the nutrition is where they'll fall down, exactly as you said, that mindset of calories in, calories out, and, well, my body fat's going up or my belly fat's going up, I need to pull the calories back, and it becomes a whole, as you said, a negative feedback loop, whether you're going ketogenic or fasting or trying different strategies. And that's the biggest misconception I've seen. When it comes to perimenopause or even postmenopause, Stacey, what is the biggest misconception you see? Is it nutrition training based, or is it something completely different?
It's both, because there's so, women are lost in the quagmire of FITSPO and Dr. Google, and you're hearing all this stuff. Like, you shouldn't do high intensity because it increases cortisol. But the follow-through of that is if you do proper high intensity, like true sit training or true high intensity interval training, then you get a boost of growth hormone and anti-inflammatory, anti-oxidative responses post-exercise and a drop in cortisol. But no one does that follow-through. So it's the misstep in the training information and really putting that eye to resistance training. There's some really good research that's come out that shows that when women do proper resistance training, so not cardiovascular-based resistance training, but real resistance training, it really mobilizes belly fat, whereas men it doesn't. So the resistance training aspect for this population is so key, and putting the emphasis on that with some high intensity work to really shift body composition. And then we're talking about the nutrition aspect. You have all that stuff out there. It's like, try ketogenic if you're peri or postmenopause, or no carbs because you're becoming more insulin resistant. It's like, well, no. We need to look at how you're fueling for your activity, reducing overall sympathetic drive, and then you're going to get the adaptations, which means you need to eat. And people are so afraid of eating. And I'm like, you need to eat. We are not Teslas that run on electricity. We are more like diesel engines that need fuel.
It's so true. I'm curious, just because what you mentioned there about the resistance training and belly fat in women, is that because of the increased insulin sensitivity or is it something else?
It is the drive of the drop in progesterone, as well as now we have this increase in insulin resistance. And so, like I said, when we're doing plyometric work and that high intensity work, you get that epigenetic change in the liver and the muscle where now you don't need as much insulin to have blood glucose control.
Yeah, that's fascinating. It's really interesting for people to know, because I think putting it all together with the training, so we've covered that, and I think it gives people a really good idea on how to approach it. With overall nutrition then, is there any do's and don'ts? Because you mentioned the ketogenic diet, you mentioned fasting. They're two that regularly come in through my space, so I can only imagine what your social media channels and DMs are like when it comes to ketogenic diet and fasting. But what are some of the best practices or nutritional approaches? We've talked about nutrient timing post-workout, that amino acids, that protein intake, but what would people or should people consider when it comes to an overall nutritional strategy for best practices with perimenopause and postmenopause?
Doing something for lifestyle instead of a trend is the biggest thing, and focusing a lot on colorful fruit and veg, not only for your carbohydrate, but also to protect and help the diversity of your gut microbiome. Because your gut microbiome is super important at this point, because you're having so much stress, you're also having changes in the hormone-related ratios. And when you have really good, diverse gut microbiome and you have more of the Bacteriotes phyla, then it encourages lean mass development and body fat loss. So it's critical to look at the nutrient density of your diet, not just calories, but where is that coming from? So we're looking at, you know, the typical whole foods kinds of things and whole grains, fruit, veg, lean protein. It doesn't matter if you're plant-based or not, whatever works for you, as long as you're getting those good hits of high quality protein. And there is that fudge factor where people like, but I want my wine and my chocolate and that kind of stuff. It's like, yes, but moderation. And if you're finding that you're not able to lose a bit of weight, then drop it out. See how that helps. And really, you know, if you're looking at trying to budge some body weight, then fueling for what you are doing and then a slight calorie restriction in the evening away from bed. So you're like, okay, I'm going to have dinner and then I'm not going to have anything until the next morning. Some people say it's time restricted eating, but what time is your dinner is the thing, right? And make sure that you have enough calories during the day to fuel for health and your activity, and then not eating 2 hours before bed. So that helps with the calorie restriction, also helps with sleep, which becomes a huge issue at this time point where women have very disrupted sleep from that sympathetic drive. So you look at the eye of how do we create a really good sleep environment? And we know not eating 2 hours before bed is one of the biggest things that you can do to really help increase parasympathetic drive to get into good sleep.
What else can people do to improve their sleep environment? Because this is definitely the thing that comes up more often than not with perimenopause and postmenopause, that night sweats or that excessive sweating and just cannot sleep and recover, what are some of the things that people can consider? Because this obviously, there's general advice when it comes to sleep, but then once you bring into the hormonal process of perimenopause and postmenopause, the advice can be slightly different. So what are some things that people need to look at?
So, you know, all your normal sleep hygiene things like you've talked about, right? You know, you could have a weighted blanket, definitely a cool room, no screen time, close to bed, not eating 2 hours. But then when we look specifically at the hormone perturbations that are happening, we know that using adaptogens is so helpful because it really helps mitigate stress. And we also look at things like tart cherry juice half an hour or so before bed. So note that tart cherry juice is not sweet, so it doesn't have a blood sugar rush. But it does improve your melatonin production. So then you can, and preferably having it cold, so you drop your core temperature before you actually try to get to sleep so that you can get into more of the slow wave sleep.
Yeah, I think that's something that can be very frustrating for people. And what I've noticed with clients I've worked with in the past is they either struggle with the nutrition element or sometimes the training element, but normally the nutrition side or the sleep side, and then their motivation just completely dips because they're frustrated and they're annoyed. Talk about the importance of the mental game and why your mindset matters.
Oh, because the psychological supersedes the physiological at every point. And at this time point when the body is so stressed from all these hormone shifts, if you can think about, you know, when girls and boys go through puberty and everybody's like, oh my gosh, the hormones are crazy. This is kind of like that, except the hormones are dropping. And that affects things like neurotransmitters. It affects sleep architect. It affects motivation, mood. And, you know, there's so many people that walk around in this brain fog where they're like, oh, what's going on? I can't think. I can't make decisions. And it is all part of the neurotransmitter aspects that are changing. So when we look at, okay, how are we going to mitigate it? It's, you know, changing up your training and nutrition. And then there is a time and a place for things like hormone replacement therapy or menopause hormone therapy. But I want to be super clear for people that it is a therapy. It's not a replacement for hormones and you're going to end up just the way you were before perimenopause. Because these synthetic hormones do not do the same thing as your natural hormones because you have other changes in the body. You have a reduction in the amount of estrogen receptors you have because as estrogen is starting to decline, the body's like, hey, wait, I don't need as many, but I need some that are super sensitive. And the progesterone is also different. So what hormone replacement therapy does is it helps attenuate things like night sweats. It helps attenuate vasomotor symptoms. It helps attenuate all of the mood changes. And it can help slow the rate of body composition change, but it does not stop it. What does is the training and nutrition. So, you know, there's a big push in the UK particularly to get every woman on menopause hormone therapy, calling that menopause is female deficiency syndrome, which is, it's not. It's part of aging. And just like girls going through puberty who might have really irregular, heavy bleeding, they might have to go on an OC for a bit. And it's the same here. So it's the consideration of how bad your symptoms are. Is it really interfering horribly with sleep? So you can't be rational because it's just impossible without enough sleep. Then you might want to talk to your GP about it. But there are other things, like I said, adaptogens. Adaptogens work beautifully. So things like ashwagandha. And for those people who don't know what adaptogens are, they are specific plants that have active phytochemicals in them that work with your body's stress system. So it's not like a pharmaceutical that takes over. If you're using ashwagandha, it goes in and reads how much cortisol you have and how sensitive the cortisol receptors are. And your body might produce as much, but it's not going to activate the receptors as it would if you weren't using ashwagandha. So ashwagandha helps everything calm down and increase parasympathetic drive, helps you sleep better. We know that rhodiola does the same thing. So there are really good peer-reviewed studies on adaptogens and how they mitigate stress. And women will start to use it and they're like, oh my gosh, now I can sleep. Now I have that opportunity to like step back and think about what's going on. The other, if those don't work, then you can also look at using a serotonin reuptake inhibitor. So we know SSRIs are pretty powerful in helping with neurotransmitter and also helping with vasomotor symptoms. So there are other alternatives to look at before you go for the menopause hormone therapy.
I'm curious, and this, I'm not sure how good, bad, or indifferent of a question this is, but from your experience, Stacey, is hormone replacement therapy overprescribed? And again, this is outside of my space. And when you mentioned the, you know, the OC, the oral contraceptive for teenagers, from someone who's done a lot of research in that side and gone down that road, massively overprescribed to people. But what about hormone replacement therapy on the other side?
It's actually a little bit country dependent. So, you know, there's a lot of fear still around hormone replacement therapy from the Million Women study that came out in the UK and the Women's Health Initiative. And then now there's more push that it's not scary to use it as a therapy. And there were new guidelines that were put out by the American OB Society that's pretty much reiterating that there's a really low risk of increase in cancers. There's a slight risk in dementia. But if you start using it at the onset of symptoms and use it for a short period of time, it's really beneficial to get through this transition. But there are subcultures that's really pushing it to stay, quote, young, where you're saying, oh, everyone should go on this. If you don't, it's super scary. You don't need to, you know, be aging out. You can use these hormones and have a very graceful, longer period of life. And it's those subsets that are really pushing it. So you're seeing things like the culture in the UK that's really pushing hormone therapy. There's subsets in the US as well. New Zealand, Australia, they're talking more about menopause in the media, and they're saying, yeah, you should be looking at using hormone or talk to your GPs, but there's a cautionary against it. So you'll see these subsets of definitely overprescription and pushing, but I don't know if there's been a massive uptake yet. More and more people are going, oh, this is the answer I've been looking for. But the more they get educated, the more they realize, well, maybe it's not. So we'll see. But OC is definitely overprescribed.
Yeah, 100%. That's something I'm very aware of on my side as well. And I think it's beautiful that you get to cover it on your channels as well, because I think it just brings that awareness to people. With the supplements then, because you mentioned Ashwanda, Rhodiola, the adaptogens, what are some of the supplements that people tend to take that they don't need?
Pretty much everything. Just kidding. No, I'd say that the things that people should take, and if it's not really on this list, then you can question it, because there hasn't been a lot of research done for women with supplementation, regardless of age. Mm-hmm. But we do know that creatine, like I said before, super important for gut and brain health, especially in this transition period and into postmenopause. We know that nitrates and beet juice doesn't work in premenopausal women, but it works in perimenopause and postmenopause for attenuating hot flashes. Because when you start losing estrogen, you start losing vascular compliance, you start losing some endothelial function, which is part of that vasodilatory constriction and response, because it's based on nitrates. So if you're increasing nitrates, either through using beet juice or increasing the amount that you're eating through your fruit and veg, you get better vessel compliance. So from a supplementation point of view, you can think about using nitrates or nitric oxide, creatine, some efficacy for collagen, because you really start seeing an increase in soft tissue and joint issues in perimenopause, because we're having more stiffness of the ligaments, we're having more stiffness of the joints and more systemic inflammation, so collagen can help. And then in perimenopause, but not postmenopause, there's a higher incidence of iron deficiency. So if we're looking at that and you end up on the low end of normal for iron, it's because your body is going through a greater amount of systemic inflammation because there's so much stress. And so you have a higher level of hepcidin. So we're looking at increasing vitamin D, especially in and around training. And if you're at the low end of iron, then you can supplement, but at least 5 hours after training.
That's so helpful for people. And Again, I will be linking the book in the description because it pulls it all together, everything from the training, the nutrition, the supplements, the sleep, and areas that we haven't even covered here. But I'm curious, Stacey, with the book now, it's done so well, bestseller list, it's helping so many people. I saw all the reviews on Amazon, which is amazing because it's one of those. I've recently had a woman on talking about PCOS. And when I think PCOS, I think menopause, I think areas that are just underserved and people can feel frustrated and women can feel frustrated. So the fact that this book is out there bridges that gap and educates people on what they need to know. So I'm so grateful that it's out there for people. But since it's been out now, what's the section that's been most quoted back to you so far, or what area of the book has been quoted back to you most so far?
Lift heavy shit.
Why do you think that is? Do you think it's because women, and this is, there's a bit of an availability bias on my side here, because I have a lot of women who listen to this podcast, follow me on social media. A lot of them will follow you as well off the back of our first episode for sure. But they know they need to lift. They know they need to do strength training, resistance training. Is that just because people still have this misconception around women lifting heavy shit?
Yeah, for sure. And it also is allowing women who love to lift to have the opportunity and voice to be like, yeah, I'm empowered. I can go in and I can do heavy deadlifts and squats because I'm supposed to lift heavy shit. So it's kind of like the permission. And it's really cool to see the empowerment that comes with that.
I love that. And when you were researching, Stacey, you've been in the weeds of this for so long. In our first episode, and I highly recommend even those who are listening to this in perimenopause, postmenopause, to go back and listen to the episode we did, 338, Sex Differences Between Men and Women. And I got so many messages off the back of that where awesome. Females were like, it was amazing because there's this huge, and you talked about it, that a lot of the studies on different things with training and nutrition are done mostly in men, and there isn't the same volume for women. And just making them aware that it's not a one size fits all. What applies to a man doesn't necessarily apply to a woman, and vice versa. But when you started to kind of go into the weeds of, say, the book research and kind of putting everything and formulating it together, was there any area that surprised you, particularly when you started to do a deep dive? Any area that you covered and thought, you pulled the thread on it and went, wow, there's actually a lot more to this than I thought?
And full disclosure, no, not really. And I say that because when I was doing my postdoc and research at Stanford, I was working closely with Marcia Stefanik, who was the PI for the Women's Health Initiative. So I was very aware of things that worked and didn't work. And I also had the opportunity to work with one of the top researchers in complementary alternative medicine. At the time, I was like in my early 30s and racing bikes at a high level and going, whatever, perimenopause, postmenopause. It's interesting, but not my thing. But then it all kind of sunk in. I was like, wait a second, we're seeing all this stuff, and I have one hand in human performance, one hand in public health. What if we start crossing them? So early days, I was doing research and understanding this and understanding things like adaptogens and complementary alternative therapies instead of going on hormone replacement therapy and understanding the research behind it all. So when I started getting questions, I was like, this is how we put it together. And being a physiologist, I can explain why. It wasn't until we put it in book form and saw it all together that I was like, whoa, there's a lot of stuff there that no one ever talks about. So I think the biggest thing was when you put it all together and realize that this is going to change people and make people like sit up and go, wait a second, that's not what people have been saying. Where I was like bracing for that storm of negativity, but in actuality, it's not negative. I was like, oh my gosh, people are so receptive to this. And it's been part of what I've been doing for, you know, over 10 years now. And so it was kind of a breath of fresh air when I was bracing for so much backlash and not getting it.
I love that. And I'm so happy to hear that, because particularly the fitness industry, it's a place that isn't always the most positive place, even when, you know, where you're coming from and where others are coming from, it's from a place of service and trying to help. But sometimes, as you said, there's a backlash by trying to change the paradigm and the shifting of conversation from this is the way it's always been to actually, this is what the evidence says, this is what the science is saying, this is what you actually need to know. So I'm really, really happy to hear that. Stacey, I just have a couple of more questions to wrap it up. And as I said, highly recommend for everybody listening, picking up the book, following your Instagram page. A lot of, we'll be already doing that from our first episode, but you're putting out great content on there. It's one of my pages I go to just cut those gaps in my knowledge. So I'm really happy to put that out there. Again, one of my favorites. But with the perimenopause and the postmenopause we've talked about, is there anything that
is profoundly different in terms of an approach from perimenopause to postmenopause. So we've talked about, you know, building in perimenopause the nutrition, the training, the sleep, and then transitioning and keeping it into postmenopause. But is there anything that is glaringly different in terms of approach that people should take when they go from perimenopause into postmenopause? Or is it build a foundation in perimenopause and then just ride that wave and ride that train all the way through? What's your take on that?
It's never too late to start the changes, because I'll have women who are postmenopause going, well, this doesn't apply to me because I'm not perimenopause. And I was like, well, no, it's not too late to start these changes. And then I'll get the pushback, oh, my joints hurt. It's like, well, if you do more mobility and you build up the strength, it actually helps with joint mobility and reduces the pain. So when we're looking at transitioning in, there are definitely individual considerations, as with everything, but starting with getting people used to the resistance training so that when they get into postmenopause, they can still be confident to go in and lift what's heavy for them, right? And just maintaining that. And the high intensity work, it doesn't have to be CrossFit-esque type high intensity. It could be running up your stairs or, you know, doing a fast walk up a hill for that short burst of time. And it's always starting slow wherever you are and then building up to it. But yes, definitely starting, if you can, in the mid to late perimenopause years and carrying it right through. Because then we're looking at better bone density, we're looking at more lean mass, we're looking at better balance and cognition for women who are getting older. So if they happen to misstep off a curb, they're not going to fall and break something. They have the ability to react. So all of these things are also an eye to having a better quality of life when you get older.
Have you found that people in perimenopause are more receptive and open to the information that you're giving than people in postmenopause, or has it been kind of positive all the way through? And again, availability bias on my side, I found that my perimenopausal people I've spoken to are very much into the lifestyle and they're looking for tools to help them. And sometimes when I speak to people, older generation, postmenopause, they're kind of like, well, you know, there's nothing I can do. I'm stuck. Mindset's nearly closed off to it. Have you found something similar, or is it different from your side?
Definitely. Like I said, when women are postmenopause, they're like, well, this doesn't apply to me. So it's a big education push to be like, no, it does. You've gone through the hormone drop, and yes, your hormones have dropped, but it's not too late to create those stressors and those epigenetic changes to support your body how those hormones used to. It's going to take a bit of work, but we're not looking for you to go in and lift 100-kilo deadlift tomorrow. We're looking at small implementation changes so that you're comfortable and your body has the ability to understand that stress and adapt to it without getting injured. Because I think that's the fear of a lot of women who are in that postmenopause state, where they've been told, oh, well, you can't do high intensity. You have to take care of your bones. You should only be doing walking in moderate intensity. And if you're doing resistance training, you're only doing body weight stuff or 8 to 15 reps. And there was a study that came out maybe 4 weeks ago where they implemented power type training in women who were 70 and 80 years old instead of your traditional like 3 sets of 10 reps. And they did so much better with regards to neuromuscular control and developing lean mass than women who are just doing the other kind of resistance training. So the type of resistance training is super important, even when you are in your later postmenopausal years. So it's never too late to start. It's just looking at the mindset and trying to work within that mindset to say, hey, yep, I know you're concerned and I know you don't like resistance training or you don't like doing high intensity, but let's try it. Let's start with one thing and work our way up through it, because it is never too late to implement.
Yeah, I think the advice based on, and you have to take that mindset shift that if you're in your 20s versus in your 40s versus in your 50s, you could do more of what you want in your 20s for the most part.
Oh, yeah.
Because
for sure.
You know, you love to run, you run. You love to lift, lift. Whereas when you come into that perimenopause, postmenopause, you're using it nearly as a prescription, an exercise and eating prescription to help you deal with all the negative symptoms. And I think when you flip it that way, that you might not love to train this way, you might want to do other things, but think about the benefits that you're going to get. I think that can be really helpful for people, and I think the book condenses that. As I said, it pulls it all together, everything we've talked about today and more. Like, we've only touched on the surface of what's in the book. Stacey, I just have one final question. You're doing so much now between the research. I know the book is helping so many people. You've got your social media content that's going out there, but what's the thing you're doing now that you're most excited about? Or is there a particular area of research that you're incredibly excited about, or what you're preparing to do next? Anything that jumps out at you that's getting you particularly excited at the minute?
Oh, goodness. There's so many things. Like, I've gotten involved in some cool companies that are putting out some really cool stuff, like Tonal's doing some really cool stuff with resistance training and trying to encourage women who are peri and postmenopause to lift differently. We're still doing cool sex difference research on rehabilitation and concussion stuff. I'm excited for a Roar revamp that we have. So we're going to revamp Roar, update the science, because, you know, science changes. Mm-hmm. And also going now back to the early stages and going to do something similar in the puberty space that we've done with Roar and the peri-postmenopause stuff. So lots of stuff, lots of cool stuff coming up.
That sounds amazing, because you're covering basically the entire cycle from adolescence onwards, if you end up covering that. So that'll be fascinating. I'll be following from afar for sure.
It's primarily because my daughter is 10.
Get the information now for the next few years ahead.
Yeah, I'll be living it and researching it at the same time. And that's kind of what happens. Like, Roar came out, and now perimenopause and stuff, and now, you know, puberty stuff. So yeah, it's a glance in the life of a working mom.
I love that. And my daughter's 7, so I'll be following as well. Yeah. So again, something I'm very interested in, just to be aware, because the more education and awareness you have, the better you're able to serve and help. As someone that has obviously never been through that side of life from the gender standpoint. So I'll be looking forward to that when it comes out on your channels as well. Stacey, as I said, I can't thank you enough. I love the Instagram page. One of the ones I check into regularly to fill in the gaps of my knowledge. I think this book is going to help so many people, similar to Roar. I know that the impact it's had and the mindset shift when it came to sex differences, this is going to do something similar for next level when it comes to perimenopause and postmenopause. For everybody listening, where's the best place for them to catch up with you? Is it on Instagram? Is it through the website? And tell anyone where they can pick up the books, and I'll link all of those in the show notes in today's episode.
So if you go to the website, you can have a big picture of everything we're doing, from like the micro learning courses we're putting out to the big courses. There is all the projects that I'm involved in. So if you want like the big picture, but if you're looking for really good hits of information, then it's again, social media, Instagram, Facebook, Dr. Stacey Sims, same with the website, drstaceysims.com. And then what else? Yeah. If you're into really geeky stuff, then you can look on Twitter where I put my academic work, but yeah, you know. I'd rather disseminate it into bigger, widespread stuff. So
yeah, that's my sister's research lecturer as well, and she follows your Twitter, so she's into that side. She's got the geeky side covered and loves that element too. I'm not on Twitter, so I'm not following anybody on there. Yeah. And for everyone listening, I will also link the book. I'll link Roar as well and Next Level in the show notes, the Amazon link, so you can click straight through. And for anyone that is listening, you can click on the links through Spotify, through Apple Podcasts, wherever you're listening to podcasts, and on BrianKeenFitness.com, where the show notes will be available. Stacey, thank you so much again, and keep doing what you're doing.
Oh, thanks, Brian. I love chatting with you.
Pleasure was all mine. There you have it, Dr. Stacey Sims on Next Level, your guide to kicking ass, feeling great, and crushing goals through menopause and beyond. This is an episode and a topic that I've wanted to cover for quite a while on the podcast. I know it's one that potentially will connect heavily with you if you fall into the demographic perimenopause, postmenopause, etc., or if you're similar to me, a fitness professional who wants to educate yourself on the topic. And I learned loads from today's episode, as I regularly do when I follow Stacey's content. So I'm really glad that we got to have this catch up on today's podcast. If you haven't listened to our first episode, episode 338, talking about nutrition and training sex differences and why women are not small men, I highly recommend you check that out off the back of today's episode. That's everything from me this week. Catch you all next Monday.